In this lecture, we're going to talk about managing the scope of a project. As a critical component of the triple constraint, an increase or decrease in the scope of the project has a direct impact on the schedule for the project, as well as its cost, as well as the quality of the deliverables. So an increase in scope can negatively impact the time and the cost and the quality, and a decrease in scope can sometimes have a positive impact on the schedule as well as the budget. When we talk about scope, we're talking about three primary components: the deliverables or end result of the project, the size of the project, the magnitude, as well as the process involved in order to get to those deliverables. When we talk about managing the scope, we're talking about a few different activities. First of all, defining what that scope is so that you can determine how big this project is. Oftentimes, a project sponsor will propose a project without fully realizing the magnitude of effort required in order to achieve those deliverables. So it's important for the project manager to clarify what the expectations are and define that scope. And when clarifying expectations, we're talking about not just the project owners, but critical stakeholders as well. You may at this point in time find a difference of opinion or differences in expectations, or differences in definition of what that project would entail. And that's a very important part of the scope management process, is listening to these different stakeholders and arriving at some agreed upon objective for the project. And another important component of scope management is to not only specify what is in the project, but also to clarify what is not included in the project, so that if you have a stakeholder at the very beginning who wishes to get something accomplished through the project that is not going to be covered in this particular project, that that is clarified, and I prefer to put that in writing so that it doesn't come back later where that stakeholder again raises the same issues when they have already been addressed very early in the project definition. Scope creep is what we are aiming to avoid here. And scope creep is defined by adding just little pieces of work, bit by bit, seemingly innocent, but when you add them up, they tend to blow your cost and your time estimates completely out of the water. And so scope creep is what we aim to avoid here. What I'd like to give in terms of an example of scope creep is when any stakeholder, whether it a project sponsor, member of a team, end user, prefaces a request by saying, while you're at it, if you would you not mind adding this or doing this? And couldn't you just add this particular component to the project? So those are sorts of phrases that appear to be innocent, but can be the beginning of some scope creep. So we will talk in the scope management discussion about how to avoid scope creep, and certainly how to identify it and make it more transparent, requests to add to the scope, so that you can control this. So back to issues relating to defining the scope. There's a project document called a project charter, and it has two primary components. One is a formal recognition of authority, and the other is a statement of work. And I just want to note that there is an example of a project charter in the Blackboard site under course documents, so that you can see an example of this. So let's talk first about the formal recognition of authority. in my discussion of different organizational structures, you may recall that under the functional hierarchy, in the functional organization, it is very difficult for a project manager to navigate the hierarchy and the organizational chart in order to get decisions made and support for the project. So in response to that difficulty, there's something called a formal recognition of authority. And what this does is it's a document that announces that a new project has started and that management, the project sponsor, whether that's one person or a group of people, that they support this project as well as a designated project manager. So what this does is it recognizes that the project manager, although he might not have formal authority in the organization itself in terms of its functions, that project manager has been elevated in terms of his or her authority with respect to the project. So if you think about an organizational chart, and let's say the project manager is normally at the director level of that organization, by a formal recognition of authority, that project manager may be elevated to a much higher level, such as the vice president's level, with respect to that project. So it's only with respect to the project, but it puts people on notice that this project manager has a higher level in terms of decision making. Now, I know this is not real easy to read, and I have a copy of this also on the Blackboard site, but take a look at this memo here. This is an example of a formal recognition of authority. If you look at the first paragraph from the Vice President of Special Projects, you'll see that this person is announcing the good news that the organization has been approved by a customer to conduct a project. That first paragraph talks about how excited these folks are about this, how prestigious this opportunity is. So what you're doing here is senior management is announcing its support for this project and emphasizing how important it is. Remember, in a functional organization, focuses on the day-to-day operations. So this allows people in the organization to see that this project is of critical importance. So the second paragraph talks about establishing a project office and announcing Fred Jones as project manager. It talks about who Fred's going to report to and how he has been delegated the authority to manage, and I'm quoting now, all activities necessary to fulfill our contractual obligations. So it says that Mr. Jones will be held fully responsible and accountable for all aspects of the project. So what this does is this highlights that Fred Jones has been given significant authority to manage this project. And by copy of this memo, everyone is advised that that he has been given this responsibility. Now I'd like to take you down to the second to the last paragraph that starts with congratulations. This vice president is congratulating everybody who has helped, and then also he's asking, I am asking for your full support for Mr. Jones and his team in this most important business opportunity. And he then says he's counting on them to deliver as promised. So what this does is this announces the importance of the project, it announces Fred's role in it, and it tells everybody that they need to fully support Fred Jones in his efforts here. And this does a couple of things. Not only does it announce what I just said, but it also prevents people from trying to do end runs or saying that this is less important than what their day-to-day work is. So it puts employees on notice. It also puts senior management on notice that everybody needs to get on board and support this project. All it takes is a memo, but without a memo like this, it can become very complicated for the project manager to continue to try to get everybody's attention and support for a project. So through the formal recognition of authority, the project manager gets something called referent authority. So he or she already probably has expert authority. They might be a knowledge expert in the area of the project, or they might certainly be an expert in managing any type of project. But also this referent authority is the use of someone else's authority. So that vice president of special projects has essentially given Fred some of his authority in order to manage this. So the second part of the project charter is called the statement of work, which is really a collection of documents. And the ones that I have starred here are the ones that we are going to focus on in this particular lecture. So it's an identification of the stakeholders, some key components of the scope statement, some idea of the organization for the project or the chain of command, who can make what decisions, and then a change control system for the project, which is the component for reducing scope creep. Critically important for the management of the scope is to identify the key stakeholders on the project. And this shouldn't be done by just one person. This should really be a team effort. It is much better to identify more stakeholders than necessary than to forget a critical stakeholder. So ways to identify them are through a brainstorming session or your first planning meeting, but the idea is to identify not only who the stakeholders are, but also their roles in the project. For example, are they going to serve as an advocate for the project? Are they representing a key interest group? So what will they serve? What is their role in the project? Are they an end user? Their level of interest in the project. This might be a key stakeholder. Let's say it's a physician who has always been interested in automating the operating room or changing the information systems in the operating room. Might be the chief of surgery who has this interest. Whoever it is, what is their level of interest? Is it a high interest? Is it just moderate? Is it low? Their influence on the project. Here's where you get into some of their political influence in the organization. Or if they are the critical end user, obviously they have a high level of influence on where this project goes. And then how they might be able to contribute to the project. Do they have strong communication skills? Are they willing to meet with other constituents to assist with the project? Do they have some technical expertise where they might be able to provide assistance? Also, as part of the stakeholder analysis, would be a communication plan. So written here as suggestions for managing the relationships. How are you as project manager going to communicate on an ongoing basis with each of these stakeholders? And in some instances, members of your team can do that as well. But I would recommend some caution on that. When you're talking about communicating with major stakeholders, be careful about delegating, because you don't want someone on your project team being tasked with responsibility to communicate on an ongoing basis with a highly influential stakeholder and having to say no to that stakeholder. It's better, in my mind, for the project manager to carry that load and have that ongoing discussion with that critical stakeholder rather than subjecting someone on the team to do that. And this document, at least some components of it, should be for internal use only. Obviously, you can identify who the stakeholders are and their official role on the project, such as sponsor, end user, member of the team, etc. But some of these other issues, such as their influence on the project, and even perhaps their level of interest on the project, you might want to keep internal. So this is a template for a stakeholder analysis. You'll see here that I've divided it into primary and secondary stakeholders. Primary stakeholders are those who have a direct stake in the project. They are actively involved in the project, or at least should be actively communicated with. You'll see here that we have their role, their project influence, low, medium, or high. How you're going to communicate with that person, how frequently, whether it's going to be by email, by meeting, by phone call, and then the person responsible for that communication. You'll see here I have a category called secondary stakeholders. This is a little more difficult to identify, but this is where you might put people, list people that aren't directly involved in the project, but you still have to communicate with them on a regular basis. For example, if you're rolling out a project in one area, you're testing it perhaps in one area and then going to roll it out in other areas of the organization. Your testing area might be your primary stakeholders, but where you might roll this thing out 6 months, 1 year down the road, you might want to list your secondary stakeholders so that they're familiar with what's going on with the initial rollout and they can have some input up front so that it will impact them later. Similarly, sometimes people define secondary stakeholders as your customers of your customers. So they might be people who are related to your primary stakeholders, but not necessarily directly related to you. Don't get caught up in who's in the primary category and who's in the secondary category. The most important thing here is to have a comprehensive list of stakeholders so that you don't miss anybody. This has been a mistake I have made, actually continue to make, is missing a key stakeholder on a project. And they will come back and let me know I miss them. And just the fact that I miss them in the first place, it sometimes puts me in a situation where I am constantly doing damage control with that stakeholder through the course of the project. So it's much better up front to talk with them. They might tell you they really aren't interested in hearing much about the project. Just communicate with them as with another large group, nothing special, and that's fine, but at least you identify them up front. Another thing is this may change. I had a primary stakeholder in a lot of my projects who was the chief of surgery, and the administrative suite at the hospital was on the same floor as the operating room. And I initially had set up so that he and I would meet weekly at a specific time period. And after we tried that for 1 or 2 weeks, he then said that this just wasn't working for him. What he wanted was for me to call over to him on, let's say it was Tuesdays, and then he would walk over between cases to the administrative suite, and we would have a 5 or 10 minute very brief meeting to talk about key aspects of the project. So while I had originally put in my communication plan that we would meet for a half an hour once a week over lunch, he changed that and said what worked better for him was for, you know, this arrangement for me to call him and him to come over between cases. So that might change. One more critical piece here is you may have a primary stakeholder who has a very important role on the project who may tell you that he or she does not need to know much about the project and doesn't want to know the details. I'm going to give you a little example here. I had a person, actually a senior vice president of the organization, that had a critical role in the project but told me he didn't want to hear about the details. But the problem was, if let's go back to that chief of surgery. If there is a problem on the project and the chief of surgery is upset, even though I am handling that problem with the chief of surgery and have promised a solution and have it under control, I still need to tell that senior vice president what's going on in case that chief of surgery stops him in the hall and starts complaining about the project. So what I've been known to do is actually chase or track down that senior VP who says he's too busy to talk to me, so I will walk with him on the way to his next meeting, and I will give him a very brief summary of what's going on with the project that goes something like this. Dr. So-and-so is very upset about the project because his OR got disturbed when he was doing surgery by the jackhammers in the emergency department addition. So we had to shut down the emergency department addition until we could figure out a way to schedule this so that it wasn't interrupting the OR. We had not anticipated this because the OR is neither above nor beside the ED, but still you could hear the jackhammers from the operating room. So I have put the project on hold while I'm working out some arrangements with Dr. So-and-so. I just want you to know he is satisfied with what I'm working on, but he is still upset about how this came about. So if you see Dr. So-and-so, I want you to know that I've already talked with him. I've told him it's under control. I promised him I would get an answer by noon, and we are working on it. Just want you to know, thanks for listening, didn't want you to be surprised. And then that senior VP can go into his or her meeting, and inevitably Dr. So-and-so is going to pick up the phone or interrupt the meeting to complain, and the senior VP, rather than saying, I don't know anything about this, I'll have to get back to you, can say, actually, Laura's already talked to me about it. I understand you two have had a discussion. She tells me she's working on a solution. She has promised to get that solution to you by noon. Is there anything else that hasn't been addressed? We are very sorry that this happened, but we're working on it. It's a very different scenario, and it gets back to my philosophy of no surprises. It's not only no surprises for me, but it's no surprises for some of the critical stakeholders, the project sponsor, and even the end users, whenever we can prevent that. But that scenario is that I need to be communicating with some of these primary stakeholders, even though they might not feel like they need it. So just to keep that in mind, I try to do it quickly. I can talk very, very fast if I need to. I can put it in a brief voicemail. I can put it in a bullet-pointed email. But sometimes I have to chase somebody down the hall just to make sure that they have a heads up and they are not surprised. But note here that the method of communication is, here's the problem. I've identified it, or somebody else has. Here's what I'm doing to resolve it, and it will be resolved. Another way, if I need this primary stakeholder or the sponsor to actually make a decision for me, I will say, here's the problem. I have identified three options. Here are quickly the pros and cons of each, and I recommend this particular option to move forward with the project. So in other words, I have helped that sponsor make a decision that is in the best interests of the project. I have not gone to that sponsor and said, I need help, what do I do? Because that sponsor is not as familiar with the details of the project as I am. So instead, I set them up for what the issues are and how best to address it. So communicating, this is another reason why I don't like to delegate this to members of the team, because sometimes you're involving some very high-level people in the organization. As part of clarifying expectations with these stakeholders, once you've identified the stakeholders, developed a communication plan. Now it's time to start talking with all of them, whether in groups or in individual meetings. But it's good to establish some sort of project, some project rules here. What you're looking to do is get agreement on the project goals amongst all of these stakeholders. You will not get everybody to agree. This is not the time to look for consensus. It would be ideal if that happened, but there are probably going to be some stakeholders who are looking to expand the scope even at this early stage, and you might need to talk with them about trying to carve out what they're looking for and define it as a separate project or a phase two of this particular project. But you have to get some sort of agreement on the goals amongst all the parties involved. Also, the rules, and we'll talk about this, is one of them is to get control over the scope of the project, and that's the change control system. And that's part of what you have to do up front, is to say that this project is going to have some boundaries that need to be adhered to. And then finally, getting support of senior management for the project. As part of the scope statement, what we're doing here is starting to put some definition to this project, developing and confirming some sort of common understanding of the scope. There's several components of the scope statement, justifying why the project is going to happen. Again, you can tie this into the strategic objectives of the organization. A brief description of what the project is going to deliver, and then some objectives that will identify how you will define whether the project is a success or not. And this is where I start to get very detailed. If someone in the information systems area is defining a successful IT project implementation according to their specifications, that can be very different from the end user's definition of a successful IT implementation. So right in the middle of that, somebody needs to be talking to both of those parties and saying, how do you define success and what does it look for you? Functionality might be very different from the IT folks. For the end user, it might be how many clicks it takes to get to a particular screen. It might be the way the icons are lined up. It might be whether it makes staff in the operational area more efficient or whether it bogs them down. And this is where IT projects have so much difficulty in implementation, is that that communication does not take place, or the person who is managing the project is not what I'll call fluent, both in IT and the end user's language. And it becomes really, really difficult to get these things, to get that final approval at the end. So this can be where it's important to do mock-ups, to do trial runs, to do beta testing, to make sure that the end users understand exactly what this project is going to entail. So even though you might have a state-of-the-art information technology, if the end user doesn't understand it or it doesn't deliver what that end user is expecting, it can flop, just as the Cedars-Sinai example demonstrates. Another example of this is when you are doing facility renovations. Often the clinical folks don't understand how to read architectural drawings. So a lot of time has to be spent up front helping them to do that. And then what we have learned, or I should say what I have learned for many facility projects, is actually to do a mock-up in a conference room where we tape the floor and show the boundaries of a proposed clinical room. We tape in where the equipment is, where the bed is, and then we ask the physicians and nurses to go in there and try to see if they have enough room. We have too many times designed clinical space that didn't incorporate all of the equipment or all of the elbow room that the clinicians required, and have learned to make it a little more real for them, either taping it in or even doing some mock-up of the walls. Again, this is lengthening the planning process, and I often get pushback on that, but I have found that we are lengthening the process much more if we have to be ripping down walls once they've already been constructed. So this clarifying the project scope and clarifying expectations is not a rush job. It really needs to be done thoroughly so that everybody understands what the project's going to achieve, what it's not going to achieve, and what it means for all the parties involved. Here's an example of a scope statement, or I should say a template, where you'll see that there's a project justification, there's a description, there are some very clear deliverables that are going to be achieved with this project. Note that since this is a template, yours would be much larger than that. Since it's a table in Microsoft Word, it would just expand as you add a detail in there. You'll also note I have a category there under the project deliverables called known exclusions. And this is where I note what critical stakeholders have perhaps asked for but will not be part of the project. And as a result of those discussions with those stakeholders, I put those in here so that there is no misunderstanding or so that an influential stakeholder, even though I've explained up front that this will not be in the project, that they don't try to do an end run and still try to get it in later on in the project. So I put that in writing up front. And then project objectives. These are quantifiable criteria. So putting what the budget is, the schedule, when the start and stop dates are, any quality measures so that we can define what will be an acceptable project for the end user, what's acceptable for other stakeholders, and any other information on the project. So this is not a difficult document to put together, but it's often missing in projects. I recommend that it not be in technical language, that it be in language that everybody can understand. I've mentioned a few times now how critically important it is to fight scope creep, and a very easy way to do it, easy in terms of putting the system together, not so easy in terms of getting buy-in for it, is a change control system. And what this system does is it makes it difficult for anybody to add scope to your project once you have received the go-ahead. Once you have defined your scope and gotten approval for that, this system needs to be put in place so that somebody won't start adding to the scope. So it's a formal system. It should involve some paperwork. And what that paperwork would identify is how someone would request that scope, that they add to the scope or they add to the cost of the project. So it would document the following. First of all, when the changes would occur in the project. Once we put together a timeline, it might be that somebody is looking to add some scope at a certain time in the project. It would also identify how this is going to take place. And this is often because when someone is requesting a change to the scope, particularly scope creep, they usually think it's not going to be very difficult. I was guilty of this as well. As a non-technical end user, I would often think that if somebody in IT could just make a little change to perhaps the screen or move some icons around or add a field to a form, an electronic form, I would be thinking in my head that this was just going to take 4 hours for them to change. Then what would happen is the IT folks would get back to me and say, actually, this is a 3-week change, or this is a very comprehensive change because it impacts other information systems. So the how is very important, is how it's going to impact the project. So not only when it's going to impact the project, but how it's going to impact the project. And also who is requesting the change, and how they're going to pay for it. So there are a lot of different aspects to the change control system that need to be highlighted. So if you have a form that asks, and I'll get to it on the next screen, who's asking for the change, why they want the change, how it's going to impact the project, and who's going to pay for it. This required paperwork would need to be approved by either the project manager or perhaps a change control board. It might be three people involved who need to approve these changes to the project. But the idea is to implement some formality to it so that an influential stakeholder cannot just call a member of the team and say, while you're at it, could you just make this little change? And I'll give you a little hypothetical here. If you have a guy on your project team who is very nice, I like to call him Nice Joe, he always wants to help. People like him very much. He's the guy you can pick up the phone, and he's willing to do what it takes to help you out. Well, not only you as project manager knows about Nice Joe, but it's likely that in your organization, your influential stakeholders know about him too. So there's nothing, without a change control system, there is nothing preventing them from picking up the phone, calling Nice Joe, and saying, while you're at it, would you mind just working on this little thing? Now, Nice Joe, without thinking about the whole picture and understanding the implications of this little request, might say, sure, doctor, I'd be happy to do that for you. I'll work on it. I'll work it in when I can. Now, what might happen is if enough people call Nice Joe and ask him for these little innocent requests, pretty soon Joe might not be able to get to the tasks that he has promised, and they might actually be critical to the timeline of the project. So these innocent little requests that he has promised to take care of can have a much larger impact on the project. So what this does is this takes it out of Joe's hands, so that when the surgeon or the influential stakeholder calls Joe and asks for this innocent request, Joe can say, I'm sorry, but there's actually a formal process for this. I'm not permitted to approve those kinds of changes to the project scope. There's a form, and you'll have to fill it out and get approved. Even better than that is to have this document as part of your original project plans so that it is distributed to all of the stakeholders and explained to them before the project even gets underway. This does a couple of things. Let's go back to Joe. It doesn't force Joe to have to say no to the stakeholder. He just says to the stakeholder, this is not my decision to make. It also allows people to know up front how this project is going to be controlled and puts them on notice that this project is going to be tightly controlled in terms of scope. That's why a change control system is so important. So you'll see here a template for a change control system. It puts the person who's requesting it on there. When they're submitting this request, they describe the change. They have to identify the cost of the change. It might be that the project manager has to put those costs together and then provide that information back to the requester, who's affected, the effect on the schedule, the effect on the budget. So this puts some formality to the process. I have a little story that I always like to tell. When we were doing an emergency department addition, yes, that's the project where the jackhammer affected the chief of surgery in the operating room. But I used to do rounds as the project sponsor, and I would do rounds with the architect, the nurse of the ED, the contractor. And we were walking around at one point, and the walls had been up, and the lighting was in, and the plumbing was in, and I noticed an area of the waiting room that looked to be kind of dark. And so I turned to the contractor, and I said, you know, that corner of the waiting room looks dark. Why don't we add another canned light there in the corner? And he nodded and said, no problem, and we finished our rounds. And an hour or two later, he appeared at my office And he had a form in his hand. And those of you who've done construction know that that's called a change order. And it identified what I had requested. It described the change. And the cost, which I had assumed would be $60, turned out to be $600. And he asked me to sign it and approve the change order for the additional cost. This change order had its desired effect. It did a couple of things. It educated me about how much this little innocent change that I had proposed was going to cost. I had no idea what would be involved, but he would have to bring back the electrician. There was a lot more involved than I thought of just putting a can in the ceiling. So it had that effect of educating me. It also educated me about the cost and put it on me to pay for it. And so what at that point in time, what went through my mind was this. Maybe it's not so dark in that corner after all. And I decided not to proceed with the change. That was an effective change control system that had the desired change, which means that the scope was not increased. And what I do in when I work within an organization and I've actually done some consulting at Carnegie Mellon with the IT folks, is that on this form, when it's within an organization under that cost category, not only do I put the dollar amount, but I ask them for their account number so that we can charge it to their account. And that, too, gets people's attention, and then they have to start thinking, is this change really worth it? Am I willing to pay for it now that I know it's much more expensive than I had originally imagined? That's an effective change control system. You will get resistance for this. There are people who will complain that this is adding so much formality to the process, that it's more paperwork, that they refuse to fill it out. But the idea is that this project, as project manager or project sponsor, you are the one responsible for the budget overruns. You're the one responsible if it goes over schedule. You're the one responsible if you can't get the deliverables accomplished because you've been distracted by different additions to the scope. It's generally not the end user who suffers those consequences. So in the way I look at it is this is a necessary part of me being an effective project manager and reining in costs and reining in the scope, and that I will not, that I will put up with the criticism of adding some bureaucracy to the process because this is a very effective tool and that's why people don't like it so much. Anyway, I strongly recommend doing this. A lot of organizations, this is not part of their culture, but it should be. Okay, we've now covered some of the critical components of the project charter. We talked about the formal recognition of authority. We talked about the key components of a statement of work, which are the identification of the stakeholders, the scope statement, the change control system. And at this point, once you pull those documents together, it's critically important to get it signed by the project sponsor, by at least your major customer. I recommend as many major stakeholders as you can, so that you have their buy-in to all of these key components of the project up front, including that change control system so that they understand how that works. But this will help you down the road as people try to make changes to your project that you can go back and show that you have actually received their buy-in to the original scope, and that perhaps if something new has come along that can be moved to a different project, you'll then have the buy-in in order to do that. One more comment here. I don't want you to be under the impression that I love paperwork. I do not. But for some of these projects, the absence of paperwork only creates more problems down the road. And if a project is run informally and by handshakes and by vague agreements on proceeding with a project without knowing the details of what's involved there, then your project is not going to succeed. So by introducing some of this paperwork in terms of the scope statement or the formal recognition of authority, or certainly the change control system, you're just adding some discipline to the project that really needs to be addressed in healthcare. We have too many of them that are vague at the beginning, and you start trying to figure out what's involved with the project as you're proceeding. As a result, those projects do not meet expectations. So I'm not suggesting a wealth of paperwork, but I'm suggesting some strategically introduced paperwork in order to add to that, to add that discipline. Okay, our final piece of the scope management process is to define the scope through something called a work breakdown structure. And what this does is this takes a project that might at some point be vague and breaks it down into tasks so that you can add some very detailed tasks to determine how big the scope is. So you might have a project that is, for example, well, I'll use the example I'm going to do here, develop a credentials verification office for a system, a healthcare system. And one might think that that's a very simple process that involves just setting up an office of a bunch of credentials experts to shuffle paperwork around. But as you start looking at what that project actually involves, it becomes apparent that it's much more detailed than that. And that will be the example I'll walk you through in a moment here. But it identifies all the tasks on the project. It serves as the basis for developing the budget, the schedule, developing a network diagram, assigning tasks to members of the team. And this is where you really end up defining the scope. It's also the point at where you go from scope management to developing the schedule, getting into the time component of the triple constraint. So here is an example of a centralized credentials verification organization. This is a consulting project I did for a large healthcare system, and the first step in this project, which was, by the way, done under a very critical time constraint, was to centralize all of the credentials functions for approximately 15 hospitals, a faculty practice plan, a health insurance division, and at that time, the time we put it in, there were still a lot of PHOs, physician hospital organizations, that were doing managed care contracting. So the idea behind this CVO was to, first of all, make it more efficient, and also to recognize the fact that a physician might be on staff at two hospitals, therefore also be involved with its two PHO organizations. It contracts with the health system's insurance arm, and it the physician is required to also be involved with submitting credentials information on a yearly basis to all of these entities. So he might be a little tired of having to continually submit information about DEA, licensure, continuing medical education, and even some of the basic demographic information such as med school boards, etc. So the idea here is that that physician would only have to provide most of that information once every year or every credential cycle to the CVO rather than to these individual entities. Okay, so looking at the work breakdown structure, there were three primary components. Designing the whole system, it turns out that there was a pretty comprehensive information systems component to this project. There needed to be an IT system that all of these individual entities could access at one time, so that there was some information that was shared amongst all the entities, and then those entities would have individual components that were not shared, such as privileging information at the individual hospitals. So there was designing the system, going down the left-hand column, developing the hardware specs, the software specs, selecting the software vendor. There was this whole central piece, which was setting up the operations of the CVO office, which was finding the office space, hiring the staff, purchasing the furniture, lots of policies and procedures that had to be developed, and then testing them. And then this third column, which was actually acquiring and installing the hardware and the software and converting the old database and then testing the new system. This work breakdown structure is not in any particular order. At this point in time, you just have a group of people in a room brainstorming with a flip chart or a whiteboard and identifying what all of the tasks are within this project. So what you're doing is you're defining the scope. You're seeing how big this really is. So it doesn't have to be in any order at this point. You'll see some little numbers at the bottom right corner of the tasks. That is, those are estimates of the duration of the task. So if you go down that left-hand column again, you'll see develop hardware specifications. That number 5 represents 5 working days in order to do that. It doesn't say who's going to do it, doesn't say when it's going to happen, just how long you're estimating. And when we get into developing the schedule, we'll talk about different estimating techniques. So this is the final stage of defining your scope. As I mentioned, the more people you can get involved in developing this document, the better. Some software programs such as Microsoft Project, it develops, so once you enter your data, it will help you with a work breakdown structure, but it's an outline form, and it's not very visual. I prefer doing what I call this organizational chart visual, because it allows people to see very clearly what's involved. And this can be a very helpful document in terms of educating end users and sponsors who tend to minimize the work that needs to get involved, that is involved in developing a project. It allows them to see that this project might be of a much bigger magnitude than they had originally envisioned. And so it can be a very important educational tool as well. Okay, from this point on, we're finished with the scope management process of the project.